Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, September the 4th, 2001. In the Creekside Room this afternoon is Leroy Eisminger. The session number is ISL 2001-2, and the title is Prison Ministry. WAIT, we are prisoners too. Let's listen to Leroy.
For we are inmates too. And yesterday, you may have read the article that's entitled, Prison is a Place. I want to quote from that in regards to our topic today. Prison is a place where if you are married, you watch your marriage die. It is a place where you learn that absence does not make the heart grow fonder, and where you stop blaming your wife for wanting a real live man in her home instead of the fading memory of one. We discovered after about 5 years in the prison as pastor, we took a survey among the inmates, and regardless of how strong the marriage relationship was when the man came into the prison, the average length of that marriage was 3 years, and then it was ended. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Prison is a place where you go for years without the touch of a human hand accepting violence, where you can go for months without hearing a kind word. It's a place where your friendships are shallow and you keep them that way because you do not trust anybody. When we first started having our worship services on Thursday evening, our guests, we were allowed to bring in 12 people every week for that worship service, our guests often commented out in the parking lot afterward. They would say, how come the inmates sat all over the place? I mean, they didn't sit together. They kind of just all over. Well, the reason for that is that they didn't want to be close to someone because they're so confined in their cell. But another reason, they've been blindsided so many times that they didn't want anybody behind them or in front of them who could harm them. Prison is a place where you learn that nobody needs you, that the outside world can get along quite well without you. The prison is a place where you wait for a promised visit that never comes. Prison is a place where you write letters and can't think of anything to say. Prison is a place where you gradually write fewer and fewer letters until you stop writing altogether. I grew up close to our South Dakota penitentiary. Our first farm that we lived on was 13 miles from Sioux Falls. And I used to accompany my father in his cattle truck as he hauled cattle and hogs to the stockyards right below the penitentiary. The highway, old 77, went right past the penitentiary and then down the hill to the stockyards. And as we drove past the penitentiary, we would see prison inmates mowing the lawn, taking care of the flowers, watering the grass, or sitting on the steps of what was then known as the cottage. The cottage was a building that was that housed the prison trustees. And when I began my ministry at the prison, I had to unlearn something that my father had taught me. He used to say it every time we went past the prison. That place is filled with Indians, and we have to pay for their keep. Well, in those days, Highway 77, as I said, went right past the prison. And we drive past that prison also every time we went to my maternal grandparents' home or visited other relatives in the Madison area. And then for 12 and a half years, I was pastor of a congregation just outside of Sioux Falls. And I would drive past that penitentiary almost weekly on my way to McKinnon Hospital to visit some member of my parish. And again, I'd see the prison inmates on the prison grounds, and it never dawned on me once that these men were part of families back home. I don't know why I didn't think of that. They say that there are 10 people surrounding the alcoholic. Well, I'm quite sure there must be 10 people who are in some way affected by the inmate who goes to prison. On the first evening of our St. Dismas worship service, it was on Ascension Day in 1990, when we came to that part of the service where the words of the service are these, "Let us pray for the whole people of God in Christ Jesus and for all people according to their needs." And then I invited the people who were attending the worship service to offer free popcorn prayers, is what we call them. Just short little sentence prayers. And the first prayer request was this: "Pastor, please pray for my family. They're doing 35 years along with me." And that prayer request stunned me. I could barely finish the rest of the service. I was kicking myself for having never even thought of that. And the Sunday following that man's request, I was with his family down in the visit room. We'd made arrangements for this man to be present at his new granddaughter's baptism. He hadn't seen his new granddaughter, and they had decided to have the baptism down in the prison waiting room. It took a lot of red tape. We had a brief baptismal service, and all the while, this man's 9-year-old granddaughter, the little baby's older sister, stood by him with her arm around his shoulders. And then when we completed the baptism, this little girl looked at her grandpa and said, "Grandpa, when are you coming home? They've kept you here long enough anyway." Well, it would be 35 years if he completed his sentence. And that inmate prayer's request, my experience with his family down in the waiting room, visit room, got me to thinking. I said to myself, what do we have? What is available to support these family members who've got a loved one in prison? How many of you know someone who has someone in prison? My wife was. You do? Yeah. Okay. Well, I decided what we needed to do was to develop a support group for this family's members. I gave it the name WAIT, W-A-I-T. We are inmates too, because after listening to the hurts of these people, I realized that these people were really locked into the judicial system as well. And so at first, I arranged for us to hold our support group meetings in a room that Lutheran Social Services gave us. And we met every week at first. And we had six couples. There were parents who had sons in prison, a sister whose brother was there, two women who had husbands that were in prison. And when the first evening I asked them, when should we get together again? And they said, well, let's get together again next week. So it seemed at first there was a need for weekly meetings to fulfill the need these people had. And occasionally I would bring a professional in who would help them deal with some particular aspect of their emotional life that they were going through. Grief, depression, anger, resentment, feelings of helplessness, feelings of powerlessness, shame. There were several of those feelings that they needed to get help with. And I relied on these resource people who could help them latch on to the spiritual resources that would make it, that would enable them to make it through this experience. Well, we quickly outgrew the office that we had at Lutheran Social Services. And so I made arrangements to have a room at the Minnehaha County Extension Office. And we moved every week to the first and third Tuesdays of every month. The problem with meeting in the County Extension Office was that very often we got bumped. Meaning that there were some other meetings connected with the weed board or with some other types of questions that the county had to deal with. And so we were often given a kind of an anteroom in front of the elevators. It wasn't a very good place to meet. It was also at the same time that I began to notice families who came to the prison. And very often, these were poor families. I'm convinced that we incarcerate the poorest of the poor. And they would come and visit their loved one. They probably scraped together everything they had to pay for the gas to get there, but they would have no place to go at night to sleep that was safe. Some of them would sleep in their cars with their families. Down below the hill, close to the mission, there was a park, and some of them would roll out sleeping bags in the park. In that area of town, it was a safe place to do that. Some of them would stay at the mission, women with children, and that wasn't the ideal place to stay either. And so there was an abandoned, big concrete stone house on the property of the prison. Some of you know what South Dakota quartzite looks like. It's one of the things that South Dakota is noted for, the stones that have been cut. In fact, the boundary stones between North Dakota and South Dakota are 7 feet high and a foot square. And they are 3.5 feet in the ground and 3.5 feet out of the ground, made out of this South Dakota quartzite. Well, this house was made out of the same thing. It used to be the associate warden's house. But they had abandoned it because of fact that the associate warden wanted to get away from the place after his 8 hours were put in and the soil stood empty. I wrote to the director of the Department of Corrections and Cure, a gal by the name of Lynn Delano. I knew her well. And she said, no, in fact, that building is condemned. We're planning to tear it down. A week later, here came a crew to take all the asbestos out of it, and they spent over $1 million in renovating that house for another part of the prison. I don't know whether that my request started the wheels going or not, but anyway, I organized a group of people. What happened one night was that at our weight meeting, I had a lady by the name of Anne Marie Rossi come. She is a psychotherapist in Sioux Falls who especially deals with sexual abuse, and had her come to our weight meeting. And she listened to the problems that these family members, adult family members, were facing with themselves, with the rest of the family, with the community, the church, having no place to stay. And she said, I left that meeting that night and I headed for home. And she said it was kind of like the burning bush experience that Moses had. In fact, it was so strong, this vision I had to stop my car alongside the road and just wait to hear what God was saying to me. And she said, it seemed to me that God was saying to me, we've got to provide a home for these families who come a long distance to see their loved one and have no place to stay. And so we elected a committee to begin looking for properties. Right across the street from the prison was a former motel that was for sale. And we looked at that very seriously. It would have been nice, but it was in need of tremendous renovation and repair. Besides that, it was very close to a very large mobile home unit, and those people there were probably some of the roughest people in town. So we kind of discounted that, began looking, and we came across, here's a picture of it here on this particular piece. Will you pick up some for this other person who had it? This particular house, and right next door is another house situated right across the street from the bus depot, came up for sale. The interesting thing about this particular house is that back in the early 1900s, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, was the quickie divorce capital of our country. And this house was especially built for those people who came to Sioux Falls for a quickie divorce. There were movie stars, there were other influential people who stayed in this house, and it became quite a house well known because this was a place where people came to stay while they got a quick divorce. Right next door to it was another house that was for sale. The properties joined, and we ended up purchasing both properties. It was purchased on kind of a wing and a prayer. We had absolutely no money. None. We signed the papers, and The man who lived in the house next door was going to marry. He was a widower, and he had found another woman who lived someplace else. She had everything, so he didn't need any of the stuff that was in his house. Furniture, dishes, lamps, silverware, canned goods in the cupboard, everything. He just wanted somebody to buy the house and he'd turn over the key. Well, that's what we ended up purchasing. And I'd like to have you take these two articles home and read them. It would be a real good thing if you would write to the Family Connection House and tell them back in South Dakota that the pastor that was here this week is hoping that they continue the fine ministry that they're doing. Well, 6 weeks into our weight program, we realized that nothing was being done for children of inmates. And with all families of inmates who were living in Sioux Falls, wives, fathers, brothers, and sisters, and so on, there had to be children. And so we hired a lady who was a social worker and had a degree in psychology, who would go to the guidance counselors of every elementary school and high school in Sioux Falls and confidentially get the names of children and young people who had a loved one in prison. And then this person would get them in a group situation together where these kids could talk out their feelings and frustrations and whatever their needs were. And so the children's program that we developed is called the Children's Connection. And it this lady comes every Tuesday and Thursday night to the Family Connection House where the WAIT people are now meeting. We developed a 10-week course so that we could, export this program. We thought it was good enough to send on to other people, and there are other communities. We started a WAIT support group in another population center of South Dakota in Aberdeen, and also in Rapid City. But this is an outline of what you can do in your church for families of inmates. Now, I would like to have you take this Dear Abby. Would you take that out? And which one of you ladies is going to be Abby? Who's going to read Abby's part?
I'll be Abby.
Okay, you be Abby. Okay. And then we need somebody to read the first Dear Abby. Who will do that?
I'll do that.
Okay. And then there's a couple more Dear Abbys. So we need a woman for one of them. Okay, who will be the woman who will do that? Good, okay, you'll take the second Dear Abby. Let's just go on now. First one, Dear Abby, okay?
Dear Ann Landers, kudos for your comments about the future.
Excuse me, wrong one. Yeah.
Wrong place.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, Dear Abby.
Dear Abby, please continue to tell your readers how important it is to inquire about family members who are in prison. 3 years ago, my son went to prison. My sister and I visit him every other Sunday. It's a 450-mile round trip, so families have not only the guilt to deal with, but the financial burden also. The first year, I don't know if I would have survived without friends. Even people I barely knew took a few minutes of their time to say a kind word and ask how my son is adjusting. On the other hand, people I have supported during periods of crisis in their lives I no longer consider friends, because they haven't even called to ask how I am doing. The woman who was mentioned in the letter may break down and cry when asked about her husband, but she will always remember the kindness. Struggling in Arkansas.
Abby says, thank you for a letter that will ease the pain of those who are dealing with a similar problem, and particularly for assuring them that it is an act of kindness to inquire about a dear friend or family member who is incarcerated. I received a mountain of mail echoing your sentiments. Read on.
Dear Abby, my husband is in prison. When old friends and acquaintances ask me how he's doing, it tells me they still care and acknowledge him as a person. When a man goes to prison, much is stripped away from him along with his street clothes, his dignity, his pride, his possessions, and all too often his family. When an old friend or acquaintance acknowledges my husband, it's like giving him back a bit of himself. He appreciates being told that someone asked about him. What bothers me more than anything are those who whisper behind my back, don't look me in the eye, and act uncomfortable around me as if they would like to ask but don't know how. It would be much more polite just to ask.
Dear Abby?
Okay. My close friends saved my life with their friendship when my husband went to jail and I was left with three children in grade school. There are many things a well-wisher can do. Invite the spouse and children to an outing. Any simple meal will do. A coffee shop, fast food, potluck, or a picnic. Ask them to go with you to the library, a museum, a party, a movie, or for a walk. Just call just to say hi. Send a thinking of you note, a thinking of you greeting card or a note. There's a big hole in the lives of families of prisoners. In addition, the families are shamed and embarrassed. If there are children, there are inevitably cruel words from the schoolmates. I beg this friend not to let self-consciousness stop her from extending a much-needed helping hand.
Somebody else read another letter to Abby.
I have worked with inmates and their families in many capacities for 16 years. I am the public relations director of Turning Point Bridges, a 150-bed treatment center for convicted felons. It is usually appreciated when someone asks about their loved one, an inmate. However, it is best to do so in private or by telephone, especially if speaking to a wife regarding her husband. Keeping her husband's incarceration quiet may be necessary for many reasons. Many wives of inmates have tremendous financial problems caused by the husband's absence. Though it is not legal, many women are released from their jobs when their husbands go to prison. Wives of inmates are lonely, embarrassed, or humiliated, and need good friends. The wife and children did not commit the crime. They need friendship, understanding, and support.
I regret that space limitations prevent printing more of the heartwarming responses I received on this subject. The overwhelming majority were in favor of speaking up and asking about the relative in prison. Only a few readers felt that mentioning the subject would be unkind.
Okay. This is a resource that comes out, Jubilee. It says, here's how you can help. When a Christian's child goes to prison, you really hope that the church will take on some of the burden that's been thrust on you. Visit or write the incarcerated loved one. Visiting may take some work, getting your name on the visitation list, driving a distance, but your visits will be as much to the parents as they do to the prisoner. Ask the parents about their son or daughter. Don't act as if their child no longer exists. Listen. Tell the parent, I've been thinking about you and I wonder how you're doing today. Then listen without judging and without feeling that you have to fix things. Uncover practical needs. Remember that visiting the prison and receiving collect phone calls can be costly for parents. In South Dakota, a telephone call in Sioux Falls is 35 cents for the normal public. If an inmate calls his family living in Sioux Falls, it's $1.80 for a minute.
And they are not allowed to have like a calling card or anything. They must. The only way they can call out is collect.
It's like that in our town too, in Idaho. Yeah. They have to call collect.
But the charges that they are charged, it's just unreal. And we are trying our best now through the legislative process to question the telephone company that does this. I had kind of an experience with it myself this spring, and it's taken us a terrible long time to get it straightened out. An inmate that I had known in Sioux Falls had some time to finish out in California when he was released from Sioux Falls. And I knew he was in California. Several of us knew that Ron Horse was his name, was in California and getting out soon. And some of the people that I hang around with had gotten telephone calls, collect calls from Ron, asking for bus fare back to South Dakota. Well, there's a process for him to do that through the tribe. And so we were saying no to Ron when he called. But anyway, one Sunday night, I got a telephone call. Everything was automated, you know. If you will accept this call, press such and such. If you refuse this call, press such and such. Realizing that when you press refusal, that you'll never hear from this person again. So I pressed refusal, that button. Hung up. Just right away, the phone rang again. You have a collect call from such and such a prison in California. Will you accept charges? If so, press well, if not. I pressed, I will not accept charges. Well, we got the phone bill for $24.
Plus,
it came to, we refused to pay it the first time that it came. And the second time that it came, there was a late charge added on to it.
And all, it was like, for each minute, it was $12 and something. And then they add, you know, on some others. So it was like $28 for those supposed 2 minutes that we didn't
have. Whenever I tried to correct it, all I would get was automated. If you would like to talk to somebody about your bill, press this. And then one night I was determined, I'm going to sit on this phone regardless of how long that they put me on hold. And it was over an hour that I sat there holding that phone before I got to talk to a human voice. Pardon?
Should have charged them for your time.
Yeah.
They worked with you though, right? Once you got a hold of them?
Not
no.
First.
They did?
They said, we can do absolutely nothing about this. And then I said, well, perhaps you can, but I want to talk to somebody above you. And they were very reluctant to do this. I said, I refuse to pay this, and I'm asking you, how would you feel if you were in my position and a large corporate telephone company was doing something like this to you? Wouldn't you feel helpless too? And one lady said, I'm not at liberty to tell you how I feel. But that's a part of the family situation. And what I've asked certain ones of you to do, I have asked members of our weight support group to write a letter of their feelings to share with you. And I distributed those yesterday. And Mel, would you mind starting first?
Don't I read the whole letter?
Well, whatever parts of it that you can, there's some that you may not have to read.
My husband went to prison on August 8th, 1991, and was released on parole December 8th, 1994. That adds up to 40 months, 1,218 days and nights that I had to live without him. Within only 20 days of his incarceration, he was transferred to a county jail 350 miles away. I was able to visit him only twice in 10 months, and that was for only 30 minutes through the glass, talking on the telephone. It was still and is still the most traumatic time in my life. It was an absolute shock at the time, and some days I still feel like I'm still in shock. I just can't believe that something this terrible could have happened to me, to us. My husband is a criminal, a convict. This sort of thing happens to other people, not us. Things that I just read about in the newspaper. The kids to this day can't believe that Dad would do this to them. Literally pull the carpet out from under them. Abandon Mom and them to survive on their own. Many days they would come home from work or school and cry about it. Feeling so helpless, so out of control. But I don't need to tell you how cruel some other kids can be. There were harassing phone calls at first. Every time the phone would ring, I just wanted to run into the bedroom and hide under the bed. This was not my fault. Why do people want to torture me? Eventually, I had to change the phone number and get an unlisted number just to get some relief from the harassment. People can really be mean.
That probably all you need to read there now. John, please.
Yeah, this is August of 99, dear Leroy. That is written by a woman. I am writing this letter to share with you the many feelings, fear, frustration, anger, loneliness, and so forth, and the reality of surviving the prison sentence of a loved one. In my case, my husband. I used to believe in truth, justice, and a fair system for dealing with crime and punishment. However, after experiencing firsthand the system, I find myself disillusioned and bitter from the inequities and sheer randomness with which many people are treated by court officials and prison personnel. I am fortunate to be educated and employed in a good job that provides economic freedom that many others do not enjoy. I can only imagine what it would be like to suddenly survive on one income when two barely gets by. Beyond the economics, there is the constant frustration of trying to get information on what you can and cannot do. The inmate is given an orientation as part of the process under prison life, but no one orients the family or provides information on what to expect, what can be sent in the mail, and what kind of rules there are for the family. And there are plenty of rules. Although inmates lose their freedom, families lose stability and continuity in their life. Life goes on for the families, holidays, birthdays, anniversaries, carnivals, school activities. The loneliness and frustration can be deafening. All the emotions of daily life are accentuated by the absence of the loved one. And I'll skip down here to the bottom. So the uncertainty is continual along with the frustration. I continue to ask questions and continue to get varied answers. I am glad that there are people like you, Pastor Edmeyer, who can provide solace through prayerful support of the families. Without my faith and belief in God, I don't think I would have the patience and courage to continue. My husband has struggled mentally, physically, and spiritually. I have had to find the strength to encourage him in the face of my own doubts and despair. Having a loved one in prison is the most challenging situation that anyone could face. I only hope that God continues to provide me with the courage and patience to survive.
This one is written by a woman. What it's like to have a son in prison. My first thought when Pastor Ike made this request was, it's hell on earth. But there are varying degrees of hell on earth. Beginning at age 14 in our son's first drink at a cousin's wedding, purchased by an older cousin, cousin thinking God only knows what. Our son, with so much potential and so many dreams, took off on a self-destruct course that in itself was hell on earth for the entire family, and especially for him, and this did not end until he was 23 years of age. By age 17, it was evident to all concerned that our son was an alcoholic. These years were very difficult, and at 17, he was in his first inpatient drug alcohol program. Again, the following year, then followed several outpatient programs. Trouble with the law, car accidents, every imaginable type of craziness you could imagine. Jail time, prison time, all alcohol, drug related. Though alcohol was primarily his drug of choice. On a 4th of July long weekend, after a 4-day binge of drinking and drugs, he committed a felony for which he was sentenced to the state penitentiary on 3 counts. One for 10 years, second count for 10 years, third 50 years to be served consecutively. His first possible parole is in 2004, and this was written, a few years ago, I suppose. He has now been in prison 9 years. And so what is it like to have a son in prison? Your entire world crashes down. You're ostracized in your community, church, neighborhood. The news media reports the events statewide, local and statewide newspapers also carry the news. Your name is trash. There's no place to hide. And from then on, his name is never mentioned except for a few choice friends and some extended family. You go through the motions of living. You seek professional help for him and your entire family. You continue working, though your name badge now only shows your first name. You are uncertain about your son, not knowing if he had a complete psychotic break. Your heart is broken and shattered in so much pain. You feel like you could die, and sometimes pray for that. You also think it would have been better for your child to have died. And she continues on this. He has a bail of $250,000. And she says, how do you raise that kind of bail? Do you dare, even if you could? How stable is your son? Would you and the rest of your family be safe? So many questions and no answers. And she comes into a knowledge that I think some of our other letters, that the system that she thought would be helpful isn't helpful.
Okay. Martha, you have one.
Unless having experienced the trauma, no one knows what it's like to have a loved one in prison. And it is something you will never forget. This person is living with you, and within minutes, he is gone. It is almost like a death, except you know someday he will be back with you. Your life begins a whole new role. You need to make decisions and get a second job and able to exist as the main breadwinner is gone. In my case, it was to have an auction, move, and then 6 months later, move to another location to be able to visit without driving so many miles, find new jobs, and reestablish again. Your loved one will also be moved to different facilities, some miles from where you have relocated to be able to visit. So you are still traveling. Also, each facility has different rules and they need different things. So you need to send him things, or he needs to send things home. As the loved one of a prisoner, you are also looked down on by some friends and relatives, even though you had nothing to do with the situation. You feel ashamed, rejected, disappointed, and humiliated. You feel lonely and sometimes wonder if you want to go on, if it's worth it. Then you think of the loved one behind those walls, and you know he is suffering those things also, and you need to be there for him. So you go on and face it together. You think about all the crimes being committed every day, but just some unlucky ones pay the price. If it hadn't been for our faith in God, the support of the church, and the weight support group led by Pastor Eisminger, it would have been difficult to go on. Also, friends and relatives who were forgiving and understanding were very supportive.
The rest of you, as you listen to these letters, you have one, Mike?
Yeah.
You read it, didn't you?
No.
Okay, you read it here.
I remember being numb with shock and grief when the judge pronounced the sentence, 10 years in prison for my husband. What would happen to him, to us? How could we go on? How could we survive this? Was this the end of our marriage? Was it the end of the life as we know it? What a mess our lives have become. It was hard to come home after the hearing to an empty house and to think of my husband of 13 years being behind the walls with no one to comfort him. I remember the police officer handing me his belongings, his wallet, keys, identification, everything he had in his possession except for his wedding ring and the Bible that my brother-in-law pressed firmly into the hands of the guard who was leading him away. We were allowed a brief few minutes to say goodbye, hands touching hands through the glass, tears streaming down our faces, the pain, the loss, it was all so unbearable. 10 years. To us it seemed like a lifetime. The journey for me along the way was hard, one day at a time, counting the days, months, years, and I too had been sentenced to 10 years. How could I pay the bills that took 2 salaries to manage? Would I be able to keep the house? Who would there be there to do the chores my husband took care of, the snow shoveling, mowing the grass, fixing the car, household repairs? I took a second job working at a cleaning office, at cleaning office buildings in the evenings I managed. I was filled with shame. Who would be my friend? Who would stand beside me, beside my husband? How could I hold up my head? My husband was in prison. It was hard to tell anyone what happened to us. Who would even care? Even sitting in church, I felt alone. I felt that I too was condemned. Would people tell me if they knew? Would I be shunned? I remember how hard it was to visit my husband in prison, but it soon became a routine of 2 to 3 visits a week, a few letters, and 1 phone call a week. Must have lived awful close to the prison, I guess. The visit room was cramped. No touching was allowed except for a brief hug and a kiss at the beginning and the end of the visit. I remember the long waits to get in for a visit and how quickly they passed. I felt the impersonal way the families were treated. The guards, for the most part, were not allowed to be overly friendly towards us, the inmate's family, and the rules. Rules that often didn't make sense and that were changed frequently. We had no way to make a personal call to our inmate if something came up at home. You just had to wait for the next visit or had to write a letter or wait for that weekly call home. The 10 years turned out to be 6.5 years. He's been home now for 1 year and 8 months. I remember being excited and yet scared when it was time for him to come home. It had been a long time of making decisions on my own. How long would he find a job? Looking back now over the trying years, I see so much evidence of how God provided for us along the way. Through God's grace and mercy, we made it through these tough years. Many helping, caring, loving people have been there for us. The Dismas Ministry people from churches who came to the prison for church services, the weight support group, our church, our parents, our families, and especially my sister Becky and her husband Tom. Most of all, we give thanks to God who stood beside us. He's our comforter, our provider, our deliverer, our friend.
What did you hear in these letters?
Well, a lot of despair.
Pardon?
A lot of despair.
Despair, yes.
Pain.
Pain?
Yeah.
Well, there's sort of a sense of frustration with, again, the system. I mean, kind of wonder if we should think about trying to fix that. Maybe you care to comment about that.
Well, there are just a lot of things that don't make sense. One of the things that didn't make sense is the reason for this. One of the rules of our prison system is that unless a child is a blood relative of the incarcerated person, he cannot visit the inmate. Now, let's take here a woman who has lost her husband, but she has 2 children of her own. She marries the man who later becomes incarcerated, and they have a child, okay? And she is kind of the care provider for these other two. Right? They're her children from a former marriage, so, and they're young. They're maybe 5 and 3. she brings them to the prison with her because she doesn't have anybody else who will take care of them. And the prison will not let them come in to visit the inmate because they are not blood relatives. And so she would have to take them back out to the car, let them sit in the car by themselves while we went down, while she went down with her child, then their child, to visit. And so seeing that, we thought, hey, we've got to do something for those children while their parents are visiting. And so that was another reason for this house. This mother can leave those children who are not her husband's children at the hospitality house. That's one of the frustrations, one of the crazy things. Another one of them is, you know, when they visit in our prison, I don't know what it's like where you are, but when the families visit, they sit in chairs side by side like this and talk. And there's a guard down there watching, and there's a roving guard watching, and you cannot, you have to sit this way, you cannot touch each other. You have to sit and talk to this inmate like this.
No eye contact? Or?
Well, yeah, they can look at each other, but they cannot, but you can't.
Yeah, they have to sit and then they can do like this. And then if there's ever any type of movement towards the guard, come over and say, if you want another, to ever have another visit, I don't want to see that kind of behavior again. The prison is a very difficult place, and you know, the prayer that we prayed out of the green book yesterday was, help make them more humane. And I like to read an article entitled Inmates Are People Too. And this was written by, we had a town close to Sioux Falls a few years ago that was completely destroyed. The whole town, Spencer, South Dakota, was completely destroyed by a tornado. And the governor allowed trustees to come and help people sort through, see if they could find any of their possessions. In the midst of mountains of rubble, Bud's gloved hands handled the baby clothes, the crushed crib, the many destroyed household items. He handled them tenderly and delicately. He was so exhausted that he felt numb, yet filled with a determination to help these people who had lost everything in the storm. There was our governor again, shouting through his bullhorn, "Great job, you guys. We're going to bring this town to our feet again, to its feet again." The Minneapolis paper had a picture of our governor and said, "The Czar of South Dakota." He had sifted every recognizable item in his 4-foot square area and was now moving on to a new one, a desk drawer and an envelope. Looking at the name on the envelope, he noticed that it contained money, a large amount. He called his supervisor and pointed it out. It wasn't long before a news reporter and a photographer ran up to him through the piles of boards and ruin. "Hey guy, that was a pretty honest thing to do. You're a prison inmate, I guess, by the look of your clothing." I thought to myself, well, there's a genius mind. Dressed as I was in bright orange coveralls with the Department of Corrections emblazoned in large letters on my back. After the interview, I knew I'd be on the 6 o'clock news. I wasn't really too different from many people in this crowd of helpers. I'd always worked hard, but I also drank hard. Unfortunately, my drinking had brought on a crash one night that had killed a 4-year-old girl. I would gladly have been the dead one because living with the knowledge that I'd taken a life was worse than death. I determined that I will try to salvage my life, however. and I want to work to retrieve some feelings of self-respect. One of the hardest moments of my life was the day that that brown uniformed guard led me through the iron doors of the South Dakota State Penitentiary and hearing those doors slam behind me. When I entered the class called Impact on Crime on Victims, I knew I couldn't be in the room when Jonetta and Joanne Barta, sister-in-law and wife of a man recently killed in a drunken car crash. They came to our class to share how the experience had affected their lives and the lives of everyone around them. Everything that has happened in this particular class has been hard for me. The purpose was to teach us inmates to feel empathy, to understand how we have hurt people. I felt that I couldn't feel much more without my heart bursting. And so I gutted it out that day. Even though my heart pounded painfully, I was deeply afraid. Afraid of my emotions, afraid of the woman's anger, her disgust, her pain. Amazingly, though, these women were not filled with hatred and anger. They were devastated at the loss of their brother, but they told the class of 12 inmates that they knew if they kept revenge and anger in their hearts, their lives would be more damaged than they already were. This was a healing moment for me. It changed my life in a way. I felt that there was hope for me. Now here I am, out as a trustee, having an opportunity to give for once in my life, and it felt good. These gentlemen have helped us in more ways than we can count, said one of the women of Spencer as she spoke with the reporter. They've been here for us during the most terrible moments of our lives, with physical assessments, but even more, sharing their love and concern for us. They are truly great citizens, and we appreciate them so much. And then she hugged each man in our group wearing orange. Others joined her in this act of gratitude. This was another life-changing moment for me. Inmates are people too. The governor of Washington recently said this. Maybe he was being facetious, I don't know. But he said, by the year 2020, if we keep what we are doing, one half of Washington's population will be in prison, and the other half will be taking care of them. Behind every inmate, there is a family. In South Dakota, a conservative figure of what it costs to keep a man behind bars is $20,000 a year. If his wife and family then have to go on the South Dakota family welfare system, that's at least another $15,000. So there you have $35,000 to keep a man behind bars for a year for writing a $17 bad check. Does that make sense? Some of the things that are in our prison justice system just don't make sense at all. And so one of the days of our program here, we're going to be looking at a program called Victims Offenders Reconciliation Program, an alternative to a prison. One of the things that we try to get through our legislature every year, and it just does not get there because our state and our governor are presently in a punitive mode. But it would make much more sense if we could put non-violent inmates, those who have not committed a violent crime, on sort of a work release house arrest. We have the technology now so that with the kind of bracelet he would wear on his ankle, we could tell within seconds if he is out of the area where he's not supposed to be. What have we done? We've kept the family intact. We've kept this man working, being a taxpayer for South Dakota. He is not being one who we taxpayers have to take care of. Something like that would seem to me to make much better sense. But you'd be surprised at the private corporations in our country who are pushing our departments of corrections in every state to build prisons. Prisons is big business. Building prisons is big business.
Running prisons is big business.
Yeah. And so now there is a move also towards private prisons, you know. And because people see that this is a money-making enterprise. And I hope that we can engage our people in the church to be prophets. Prophets in the Old Testament sense of the word, to call attention to the injustices that are prevalent in our society. Okay, we'll stop here. Some questions and comments. Appreciate those of you who read today. That's very good.
Anyway, just quickly, I learned that just recently that in the state of Washington, or at least in the Puget Sound area, the Lutheran Church corporately has an ordained pastor who is a lobbyist in our state capitol. Haven't met him yet, but he's going to do a program for our church here in the next few months. And he, as I understand his job description, would be in a position to lean on, however that happens, legislators if the church had some particular objective for him to help them pursue. So I'm wondering, is there anything like that that you're aware of in South Dakota? Okay, that answers like one of my questions. But it seems to me that this might be a possible avenue. I mean, some of the things you're citing, I've had enough business with representatives in my state capital to know something about how the system works. And it's pretty bad. That's the short story.
I'm delighted to
learn about this possibility of having a Christian representative who might speak for us.
Well, in South Dakota, I can tell you probably why we don't. Shortly after I began my work at the prison, became aware of Dick Borwood is a friend of mine, very close friend, and he was telling me about a 4-H camp near Outlaw Ranch in South Dakota that stood empty most of the time because the program really wasn't going very well. It could be made available for housing. And I knew the director of Custer State Park, who was willing to hire prison inmates, trustees, to come and work within the state park there at Custer, cleaning up, cutting out old wood, fixing up campsites, and all of that. Well, I brought it to a group of people consisting of two legislators, several pastors, and there were some men from, some administrators from prison. And the chairman of our South Dakota budget committee was there. And after my presentation, he said this, "Roy, that's a marvelous plan, but you are the last one to present it to our legislature. Because in Pierre, pastors are considered do-gooders, and they're considered naive, and they have no credibility." Wow.
Who's saying this to you? The chairman of your state, of the legislative budget.
Yeah.
Is he a Christian?
Yes.
Well, by the same token, that's probably very good advice. I mean, given the climate that exists, that was probably, he was giving you some solid information.
Well, I have to admit that some of our clergy have really bungled the job.
Yeah.
I mean, they don't, I mean, they're, they don't look at all that's involved.
Kind of does their homework.
But I'm glad that you're going to have that person.
Our, the church that we belong to, we have a very active, what's called mission committee. And besides me that was involved because of his ministry, there were others who had been up there to visit. And we decided that in our forum, our adult forum on Sunday mornings, we would have what we called Prison 101. And we would discuss in our adult forum different aspects of this whole prison life so that people would really know what's going on. And one of the men we had come for one of our Sundays was one of our legislators. And he said, it's our fault that our prison is as crowded as it is because we legislators are the ones who decide what crimes are going to put people behind the wall. You know, these people that could be on the outside writing bad checks or DWIs or something where nobody has been killed, but they've got so many DWIs, we're putting them behind the walls. We're the ones who are crowding our prison. And so we legislators should look at what we are doing.
Well, the focus of this session has been on the families. Mm-hmm. And I'm convinced there are many things that congregations can do for families. One of the things we are involved in, Chuck Colson of Prison Fellowship has a program called the Angel Tree. Do you have that one?
Yeah, I do it.
Tell the group what that is.
Angel Tree is a process by which children of prisoners can receive Christmas gifts in the fall, probably about now. Each chaplain in every prison that are around our country is offered applications. The prisoner then may, by choice, fill it out, and they have to tell us where they are exactly, how to get in touch with them, the prisoner. They have to know exactly where the children are, what their ages are, who the caretaker is, where the caretaker is, you know, all this stuff, because more than often the prisoner is somewhere else with them, you know, apart from the family, sometimes across the country. And Chuck Paulson's Prison Fellowship acts as a clearinghouse, and then they send from the prisoner all this information. It's a neat form with all the stuff that we need. And they send it to the community that the family is in. And then he always works through churches, the whole program. So then there's a representative that will say, how many kids can you take? And our church chooses usually to take about 10 kids, and that could be in one family or two families or six families, you know, however. And so we receive then, by consent, through Prison Fellowship representatives, names and addresses in our community. Then it becomes a giving tree thing. And you know what that is, okay? We put that up and we say, this child needs, and we, the neat thing is that I, as the representative, or any amount of how many you have in your church, it's a personal contact. You know, sometimes when you work with social agencies, they don't want you to talk to the family, they do it all. Well, we talk to the family. I call them up.
And you find out what size code.
It's not a just, oh, wouldn't it be nice if they had a teddy? No, my child needs PJs, my child needs socks, my child needs a coat. And we give them what they need. Mm-hmm. Sometimes a family will say, no, that person has done so many ugly things to our family, I don't want to have any contact, I don't care what it is. And so we respect that and say that's respect. We will not. The next step is to get everybody to bring their gifts in our church. And I know your church would be generous because this is children and at Christmas, you know, we're in a giving mood. And so it works. And then somebody has to play Santa. And a lot of times I'm involved in that part. And that's loads of fun. And then the next step, the final step, to write to the prisoner and say, "Dear Bob, as you requested, your children have been given gifts, and it's a friendly note." And often I'll get a response from them.
That's a marvelous way also
of gratitude. Yeah.
Find out who these invisible people are.
Yes. I discovered there was a child two blocks up from our church.
And so,
yeah.
You know, the church, yesterday we talked about how to, well, this whole week is how to minister to the forgotten faith.
Right.
We find ways to feed the hungry. We find ways to clothe those who are cold. We visit the sick. We build houses, Habitat for Humanity for those refugees. But how do we visit those in prison? Most churches don't have opportunity or they aren't aware of what they can do. And so this week, I hope we can help you get in touch with some ways in which your church can minister to the forgotten fifth and their families.
You can, through your chaplain in jail, talk about Angel Tree, because the jails are given those applications.
So are the prisons. Yeah.
In the prisons.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.